Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. That music means we are into the Hillsdale Dialogue, the last radio hour of the week. And for the fourth week in a row, let me say that properly, for the fourth week in a row, I'm talking with Dr. Larry Arn, president of Hillsdale College, and Dr. Khalil Habib, who teaches at Hillsdale College, about Alexis de Tocqueville. And if you want to read Tocqueville, there is a Liberty Fund online edition available that Dr. Habib pointed me to. And I want to go back and summarize, or actually, I will let Dr. Habib summarize where we have been over the course of three Hillsdale dialogues and where we're going today, Dr. Habib.
Sure. So what we've covered so far is Tocqueville trying to teach his countrymen in France why liberty never really took root in France. It resulted in the French Revolution, which only strengthened despotism, and why in the United States, the American Revolution resulted in far greater liberty. And he traces it to America's connection to its English roots and its history of local participation. And so what he wants to teach the French is how vital it is to have local participation in government, to have a responsible understanding of rights and duties to one another, and the dangers of centralization, which was really the bane of France's existence. And when he's in the United States at this time, he's praising America's decentralized form of government and the energy with which its citizens pursue local participation, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and the education and the moral virtue and character of the American people.
Now, I am not using the Liberty Fund edition. I've got this one in my hand that people can watch on the website. But it's Joseph Epstein. It's translated by Reeve and the introductions by Epstein. And Epstein's little biography of Tocqueville is majestic. But he doesn't mention in there, and Dr. Arn raised last week the tension between the German historicist and the Tocquevillian Madisonian approach. I raised the question last week, and I hope people haven't forgot it. Did Tocqueville get any purchase among the Germans? He was wildly popular among the French and has endured in America. Did the Germans accept him at all as a guide to those crazy people across the Atlantic?
I'm sorry, are you asking me or Dr. Arn?
I'm asking you, Dr. Habib.
Oh, okay. Well, I can't prove it because there's no textual evidence, but there's little chance that Nietzsche didn't read Tocqueville. In fact, there are certain passages in Nietzsche's writings that disparage democracy that sound very similar. Almost like paraphrases. I'll give you an example. In Thus Spake Zarathustra, Nietzsche launches a tirade against democracy and sort of its lack of interest in the things that are eternal and greatness. And there are times it sounds as if he's almost quoting certain haunting passages in Tocqueville. He distorts them for his purpose, but in terms of the impact that Tocqueville had, say, in the United States or in France, I don't think it was too large. I think Hegel and Rousseau, who's not German, had a far more considerable influence on Germany than did Tocqueville. But Nietzsche, in my mind, certainly read him.
How interesting, Dr. Arn, especially given your comments last week, that a German of that rank among the philosophers would reject Tocqueville. And not surprising, but I haven't thought about him in England or in Germany, only in France and America. When he says, and you sent me this quote, Dr. Habib, Americans are Cartesians, but they do not know it. What the hell does that mean, Dr. Habib?
So that's the beginning of the second half of the work. And Tocqueville wants to examine the fate of literature and theology, philosophy, and the family in a world where we're becoming more and more scientific, more and more focused on the results of knowledge rather than the foundations of knowledge. And his point there, when he says Americans are Cartesians but don't know it, is that they have a certain scientific outlook that's really shaped and formed by Descartes. But we don't know it because our society nudges us away from leisure and the study of the theoretical foundations of our intellectual habits and more towards utility. And he thinks that there's a danger in that. So, for example, if you lose sight of the foundations of science, can you continue to innovate? Think about what happens if you lose the foundations of the American government. Can you really protect and maintain your liberties and your constitutional order? So that's really his concern in those series of chapters. What happens to a people? sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, that remind Dr. Arne, David Brooks was a guest about 3 weeks ago after he wrote a column saying there were some good aspects to the pandemic, including the renewed burst of energy. And it sounded almost like a panda to Tocqueville's remarkable assessment of energy in America and our scientific. But Brooks warned that when he saw it, Americans were bounded by religious common understanding. Not that they were Christians, but that they were moral. And now it seems to me that maybe the Cartesian in us have triumphed because of the German historicism you talked about, and that's not a good rebalancing.
Well, think about, Khalil said something dramatic last week that I'd never thought of, and that is that the reason Tocqueville doesn't mention the Declaration of Independence is because he's talking to the French, and they've got too much theory and principle going on in them. Well, you could read this part about Descartes as encouraging us to have more, but I think it's really encouraging us to have different, right?
Interesting.
Descartes is not a great guide, you know, and it does lead to these, to utilitarianism, you know, the trouble with which is it doesn't work.
And well, there's a lot of other trouble. Ends up with millions of people dead, too. It's a...
So it's...
These are academic humor jokes. It really, you know, our academic audience is laughing and chuckling themselves. Our regular audience, what are these guys talking about, Larry? What are you talking about?
We're nerds. Can't help.
We sure are.
Yeah, that's... And see, that's... This, you know, it is an extremely interesting book, and I think the book is used for great ill these days, as well as much good, but I've never seen it used so well for good as it is by Khalil, who I'm going to suggest on the air that we publish his outlines that he's written for us. Because
100%. He has to go back and do part one of book one so that we can get the outline for that. But let's go back to that. He predicts the rise of Catholicism, which is my church, Dr. Habib, and we'll bring Arne into it eventually, but I don't know if it's your church. Why did he do that? Why did he predict that?
Yes, it is my church as well. I just wanted to add one more point, though, to Dr. Arne about Descartes. I think that's spot on, and it is related, by the way, to the rise of Catholicism. One of the fears that Tocqueville has with Descartes is he, at some point in the book, will talk about the dangers of having skepticism take root in culture. Well, if the first half, as we discussed in the first couple of episodes, talked about how important religion and liberty were to America's founding. What he doesn't want to see is the fruit of science just bringing about machines and gadgets, but theoretically sowing doubt in the American mind. What would it do to religion over time? What will it do to ideas of morality over time? And he thinks those can be potentially crippling. How it's related to his issue of Catholicism is interesting. He thinks that as society becomes more confused, as it becomes more commercial and materialistic and egalitarian, there will be those within society who will long for a kind of hierarchy, some kind of order, some kind of connection with something eternal. And he thinks that the Catholic Church offers that and that it will actually gain more followers over time as society becomes more commercial and as leveling takes root in society. People are going to want some kind of structure, some kind of hierarchy that will point them to the things that are true and good and beautiful and the divine. And he thinks that the Catholic Church, particularly the Catholic intellectual tradition, can introduce Americans to the philosophic tradition, to Western civilization, and to things that are permanent and not just be fixated on the here and now.
Well, that was true for a while. Until the Catholic Church itself perhaps lost its compass. And it's not true anymore. In fact, the decline and fall of the American Catholic Church is rather rapid. It might regenerate, Dr. Habib, but it has not been an edifying 30 years.
You know, it's funny. I just had this conversation with a couple of our graduate students. One is a Catholic convert. The other one is what you'd call a cradle Catholic. And I asked the one who converted why he did, I swear on my life, he said, for the reasons Tocqueville gave. I was shocked. This was before I even knew that you and I and Dr. Arne were going to be talking about Tocqueville. So I think the younger generation, though, is experiencing a formidable new challenge there's an existential crisis in America that the younger generation now is dealing with. You know, during the Cold War, we can identify a country and an enemy. Today, you know, you've got this corrosive acid of ideas attacking the foundation of this country. And I think that with this new generation, especially those who are liberally educated, there are many attractions to the Catholic Church, and I've seen it since I've been at the college, quite a few converts to Catholicism.
Well, maybe another new article for you is Tocqueville on the American Church in the 2020s and what they could learn, the bishops, from him. We'll be right back, America. The Hillsdale Dialogue continues with Dr. R. and Dr. Habib after this.
Somewhere in the world, news is happening. You'll hear it here first, but only if you're here when Hugh Hewitt continues.
Welcome back, America, to the Hillsdale Dialogue, part four of our four-part series on Alexis de Tocqueville. And Dr. Habib is so far ahead of me in renewing the book that I'm just cheating off of his outline now, completely cribbing. Dr. Habib, you mentioned, I want to make sure we get to it, that Tocqueville recommended the great books to the Europeans. Well, I mean, that's kind of like taking coal to Newcastle. What was he doing and why?
he thought that the social conditions in the United States would necessarily encourage economic opportunity, and rightfully so. We're not born into a caste system. He says even the wealthy here are never sure of their financial fate, and so everybody's constantly trying to keep their head above water. And he says that this kind of economic habit increases desire, which in turn affects the imagination, and it leads us away from the permanent things that literature, the arts, and theology can offer us toward the futile attempt to satisfy desires that are simply insatiable. So what Tocqueville recommends is that he thinks that America's understanding of local governance and self, you know, participation in local associations, et cetera, has its roots in England. And he thinks that America would benefit by remaining connected to its European heritage, especially when it comes to the great works. He didn't think that commercial society would necessarily encourage great writers, you know, like a Shakespeare, a Milton, or Locke. It can produce good writers, but the American foundation of government is so rooted in Europe that he thought it was absolutely essential that we remain connected to it intellectually.
You know, Dr. Ryan, it sounds like Tocqueville should be the patron saint of Hillsdale, but I want to remind people in the first hour of our four, you voiced the concern about Tocqueville. Would you remind people about the danger in the modern study of Tocqueville? Because he does sound like a glorious endorser of everything that Hillsdale does.
Oh, yeah. Well, the problem is, there are two obvious things about Tocqueville. One is he doesn't mention the Declaration of Independence, and the other is he says that the problem with America is that equality may run riot. And so those sounds like, and you know, there's very good people, including one important friend of mine, and they say democracy democratizes. The chief danger in any regime is its central thing. And so the strategy today is to de-emphasize democracy and emphasize aristocracy. And I don't agree with that. I'm part of a strategy now for my whole adult life that, you know, in the writings of the founders and Lincoln, you can find the antidote to the craziness that's going on today. And just, for example, just in the Declaration of Independence, right, it gives a very clear definition of what we have an equal right to. And this thing that we have an equal right to is a part of our nature. It's closer, it's more central to us than even our kidney, right? You can't do without it. If you got a human, you've got this thing. And that means that it's an appeal to the nature of the case. It's an appeal, what is this kind of being, and how, because of its kind, must it be treated? And so that goes right back to the fundamentals, and there's, you know, that's, you can't understand those terms without thinking through the main arguments of classic philosophy. And so the point is, I would do that, and some people read Tocqueville to discourage that. But in the part that Lee's talking, sorry, I keep calling you Lee, Habib. Lee Habib, God we know. Khalil Habib. What he's saying is, in this appeal to us to read great books, and also things that that Tocqueville says about the university, right? They would perform a function. And, you know, one of the glories of America, right, is Professor Jaffe used to say this, when the 30,000 at a time people gathered to hear Abraham Lincoln debate Stephen Douglas, they all had two books that they'd read. They all had the King James Bible, and they'd all read Shakespeare, right? And that's, in other words, that's right. In other words, you in the end, our regime, our nation justifies our freedom in the laws of nature and nature's God. And so that's a way to encourage us to look up.
More when we return about looking up and how Tocqueville encourages the taste for well-being as well. When we return with Dr. Khalil Habib and Dr. Larry Arn on the Hillsdale Dialogue. Stay tuned.
Stop action-packed information. Blitz. The Hugh Hewitt Show is coming right back.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. In all these years of doing the Hillsdale Dialogue, I don't think I've ever referenced the joyless quest for joy. Dr. Habib put into his outline of Tocqueville. Dr. Arn knows a little bit about Leo Strauss, and he knows a lot about Dr. Habib. So I want to go right there and jump to what you say, Dr. Habib, in your outline for me, the taste for well-being concerned Tocqueville about Americans, because our restlessness and that desire are not easily joined.
Right. I mean, one of the things that Tocqueville is interested in with the commerce, he's fully aware. In fact, he paraphrases Adam Smith. He's aware of Montesquieu. He tells us Montesquieu is one of his great teachers. He's fully aware that commerce and capitalism lifts everybody's boat in the harbor. He knows that it has great material benefits. What he's concerned about, though, is what happens, he says, after 40 years of pursuing wealth to the mind and the habits that are necessary for leisure. And his biggest concern is that it will create a certain kind of restlessness where we're always pursuing what we don't have and are never satisfied with what we do have. For Tocqueville, things like the church, things like family, things like education require a certain kind of rootedness and a time out from the busy world around us. And his biggest concern is not so much the economic benefits of commerce. He knows what those are, and he admires them. But he's far more interested in the effect that it will have on, say, literature. So you know that at most universities and colleges, the emphasis is on how you can get a job. And when you look at departments that are teaching things like the classics or Shakespeare, they look like they don't have anything of value to add to a society consumed with utility and economic well-being. And so for Tocqueville, that would mean that you would sever your educational institutions from your European heritage that helped to inform the very foundation of your government. And so that was what his real concern was, that you would swap out the foundations that gave us political liberty and a certain kind of independence and ideas of rights for a joyless quest for satisfying desires that have no end.
Well, that rings very current, Dr. Arn.
Oh, yeah. It's both on the left and the right. I'm not going to name any politicians because they make me mad, especially when I talk about certain Republicans. The whole purpose of education is to produce, and that means that children are looked at as factors of production. And one of the effects of that, by the way, because, you know, if you have this curriculum, which is, it's now turned to a worse evil, but the original curriculum was, we're going to train them for success without any definition of what that is. And the point is, you're not treating them like human beings then. And the truth is, what do they love? What do kids want to know? They want to know how what everything is, right? And how it's ordered. And so we take that out of education, right? Now we're actually stamping something narrow and tight on it, which is everything is the politically correct cause of the day, congealing into race and sex, and you can't understand anything outside those constructs, which, by the way, is a self-defeating argument, right? So that just like you say about the Catholic Church, and I thought of this, by the way, the Catholic Church needs a miracle. Thank God that's the business they're in.
Yes. They have often needed miracles, and they have often arrived over 2,000 years.
And the university's in the same state, see? It's just, you know, it's devastating and dangerous for sure.
Well, you know, that goes back to the outline. Dr. Abib said that, and I want to ask him about this, that Tocqueville warned that American materialism would lead to spiritualism and restlessness. And I made in my notes as I was reviewing that the United States is home to the largest growing sect of believers in the world. On the Christian side of the ledger, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints grew out of the burnt-over district in New York and eastern Ohio and is today on every continent and numbers more than 10 million and is rapidly growing demographically and in influence and in numbers, all born out of American soil, though their prophet Joseph Smith and their apostles, one of whom is a dear friend of mine, Neil Maxwell, have all been thoroughly American and from this time that Tocqueville writes about. Have you considered the LDS within the Tocquevillian outline?
No, I haven't. So you've given me now four book ideas. So I'm going to be busy the next decade. I think that's a great point. And I think if anything, it just proves Tocqueville's original insight in the American founding and the early American Puritans, and that is that you can't have liberty without religion. And so I'm not surprised that you would have a Mormon religion that is quite patriotic, very politically conscientious. Every Mormon I've ever met is extremely decent, very responsible, and I think
very organized. And their stake system, their diocese system, it's all built. Their ward system, it's all built on voluntary association of the sort that Tocqueville lifts up. And they don't need the government. They are prepared for anything.
It's a microcosm, isn't it, of everything Tocqueville praises about America. Voluntary, it's spiritual, it has elements of liberty in it. It's also commercial. It's not at odds with commerce. One of the things that Tocqueville recognized in France is that the church and liberty were at odds with each other, commerce and the church were at each other's throats. And in America, these things seem to have a way of finding equilibrium.
Now, Dr. Arndt just mentioned the current confining construct of race and gender. Tocqueville deals with women. What does he say? You can't obviously cover it all, but what is the defining point of Tocqueville on the American woman in contrast to the European woman of his day?
Well, he treats the American family as the cornerstone of the entire nation and goes so far as to say that the fate of any country lies in the moral virtue and character of the female. And this is typical of Tocqueville. He compares the American family with the French family, and he actually praises the American family over the French family. The discussion on the family is a discussion of democracy and aristocracy. And once again, he actually favors equality rather than aristocracy. He thinks in America you have a democratic family. He calls it far more natural than the aristocratic family. And the aristocratic family, he says, is completely governed by command and obedience. It's patriarchal at its core. Friendships don't really exist within members of the family. If you want to see this demonstrated, read Samuel Richardson's Clarissa. It's the most aristocratic novel ever written. The family is unrecognizable in that family, in that novel, rather. In the American family, Tocqueville says that you have as a level of equality in the family where fathers and sons can expect a certain natural friendship and independence to emerge. And he thinks that the American female, and again, this goes back to your earlier point, Hugh, the American female, who he treats largely as Protestant. He doesn't discuss Catholic females in America. He talks about Catholic French females. But he says that in America, you have these Protestant females who were raised for independence. And that's because they're introduced to the morality of the church, and they have a certain Puritan character to them. And so they're not micromanaged, and they freely choose their husbands. Whereas in the aristocratic families in Europe, he says, they tend to be more or less arranged, and so they tend to be loveless. And he compares novels and literature in the two continents, and he says, you know, the Europeans are full of novels of women and men cheating because there's no love in their marriage. And he says, in America, you really have this Republican family where he presents the American female as a hero. I don't know any part of the book where he praises any part of America without any qualification more than the American female.
What a remarkable thing to arrive at and understand. I didn't know that part about Tocqueville. I'd forgotten it. And Dr. Arm, when did Hillsdale begin to admit women? I don't think he remarks upon, and he comes too late, too early for Oberlin, but Hillsdale was fairly early in the education of women as well, was it not?
Original, yeah, 1844. Man and woman, black and white, all alike, is what it says. And see, I want to add something to what Lee said.
Lee Habib. And Lee Habib is in my life and yours, thought. But...
right. And so, yeah.
I kind of like
so
Lee.
In one way, I'm promoting Khalil.
Yes.
Although Khalil is more knowing than Lee Habib. The ideal in Hillsdale and the practical functioning of, you know, first of all, you had to know Greek and Latin to enter Hillsdale College in 1844, men and women. And what happened to the women? They became symbols and practical embodiments of wisdom in their communities. They went back and became teachers, right? And they were the ones who'd read the great books, and they were the ones who spoke the old languages. And so that if you add to that because everybody needs leisure, which is one way a slightly technical term, it means time to think about the best things. Women were thought that they could do that, see, and have time for it. And that certainly was the ideal at Hillsdale College, and it's the way it worked out, too.
Well, they educated the frontier as well. And I turned to many authorities on that. I'm not sure if Tocqueville said that, Dr. Habib. We have about a minute left. Did he discuss women on the frontier, which is really quite a remarkable experience in the American settlement, which is unique, really, in the history of the world?
Not so much on the frontier, just a general comment that that the American wife was really a stabilizing force in not only the lives of their husbands, but their family. He says that America is a very tough place to live. Your fate is never assured. And so you're constantly fighting to keep your head above water, and that the American wife is an extraordinary mother and a great spouse, and also the moral educator of the family. So I think he would extend it to any aspect of America. He makes very general comments in that regard.
Well, very timely as well. When we come back for our final segment, we'll talk about Tocqueville's idea of democracy and liberty together. They're not the same thing, but they're interdependent. All things at Hillsdale are found at hillsdale.edu.
This is the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt with Dr. Khalil Habib and Dr. Larry Arn talking about Tocqueville, Democracy in America. And Dr. Habib, you've been wonderful. Thank you through these 4 hours of the Hillsdale Dialogue. I want to end by the dangers of centralization, because Dr. Arn and I have talked a lot about that. It worried Churchill. I'm not sure that it worried Lincoln as much as it worried Churchill, but it certainly worries Tocqueville. How so?
Again, for your audience who want to follow along, if they can just turn to page 1248, he discusses it there very explicitly. But again, I want to just remind the audience that for Tocqueville, there really is two forms of equality. He's perfectly comfortable with the equality of rights that entail a certain understanding of duty, that we rule and are ruled in turn, very Republican. The kind of equality that he does not like and worries him is a degraded form, and also a centralized government that encourages the leveling of citizens, which essentially would turn them into subjects rather than free individuals. So the centralization of government is exactly what led to the French Revolution. And his fear for America is that if it goes down the path of centralizing government, why? Well, because over time, he says, industry and commerce could potentially create an indifference to local participation. You're just too busy to focus on your own affairs locally. As you vacate the public space, someone's going to fill that vacuum. And for Tocqueville, it's always government. And so government expands, oddly enough, the more prosperous society becomes, because people seem to lose interest or just simply don't have time to govern their own lives locally. And so they tend to sort of not pay attention, and government grows and can centralize right around them without them knowing. And once that happens for Tocqueville, it's too late. You're now up against a formidable centralized bureaucracy that once it takes your rights, it's very difficult to ever get them back.
How does that sound to you, Dr. Arne? Prophetic?
Oh, yeah. And think of this point, because it's one of the places where I think Tocqueville is most beautiful. If government is decentralized, people get to be governors, which is a human function, and a high human function, right? And if everything is decided technically and remotely, this is a pandemic, right? In this town where we live, this wonderful little town, there are people whose chief job is to read complicated rules that come from above and apply them to us. And they're not very good at that, because it's not a good thing even to be trying to do. But that's spirit, right? That's something, it's a principle, and also it's a spirit and manner of living. And it comes from outside, and if you are trying to live a normal life, you don't have time to be master of all that. And so that's right. In other words, our lives, I mean, you know, are we going to be allowed to raise our children in the future? It's like it takes some expertise to be a mother. And, you know, if that were true, we'd all be dead.
So we're back at the end of 4 weeks to the beginning, where Tocqueville was animated by the French Revolution and how it was different than American. I believe I'm correct, Dr. Habib, in referring back to what you said drove him a little bit crazy about the French, is that the French Revolution was caused not because, or drove people, drives you crazy about people's understanding of the French Revolution. It wasn't that the people were poor, it's that they were ruled, absolutely.
That's right, and the condition for their servitude was actually the general prosperity. That's the interesting thing to keep in mind. He says that France was never wealthier than at the time the French Revolution took place. And what essentially happened was, over time, Louis XIV and others, centralized government, took away local liberties across the country. The aristocracy just grew indifferent and could care less about governing, and they were basically being bribed by Versailles. They were given empty titles in exchange for letting the state run everything. And the society was doomed at that point. For Tocqueville, it was just a matter of time that a revolution would take place, and a failed one at that. He doesn't think that a generation of people without political experience can ever regain their political liberty, or even know which ideas are healthy or dangerous, which revolutionary ideas would only exacerbate despotism rather than free you from it. You need real political experience for that. And politics and the practice of your own local affairs is the great educator of responsible liberty for Tocqueville.
Now, we will not be that despairing here, or even close to it, because we do have self-correcting measures. I don't believe France in 1789 had any self-correcting ability, correct?
That's right. And in fact, he said that, and that was Burke's point. I mean, Burke thought, you know, there's no reason to continue this crazy revolution. You should go back to your self-correcting institutions. What makes Tocqueville so great is, in his book on the French Revolution, he says, here's the problem with Burke's view. He didn't see that the cause were the very institutions that he kept encouraging the French to go back to. So it's really the danger of centralization that is the most common theme that runs throughout all of his works.
Well, I hope people take that away. Dr. Arne and I will be back to talk about that. I hope you're back in the future, Dr. Habib. It's been a wonderful 4 weeks on Tocqueville. I appreciate your expertise. I hope these outlines, plus more, are made available so that there's a bit of a renaissance, an appropriate renaissance, well-formed and structured. Dr. Larry Arne, thank you as well. All things Hillsdale are found at hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale.edu. All of our conversations, including the quartet on Tocqueville, are found at youforhillsdale.com. I'll talk to you Monday. Thank you, Adam and Duane. Thank you, Ben and Harley. See you Monday on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
when you absolutely, positively need the truth. This is where you turn. This is the Hugh Hewitt Show.